May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Paul Malika, and I'm representing Linda Reed, the plaintiff in this case. The district court succinctly described the stakes of the merits of the litigation when she said, in reference to Tennessee versus Lane, what good would come from ensuring that disabled individuals have physical access to a courtroom without also ensuring that they can participate effectively? And for 90% of the opinion, when we read it, we were very happy with the results because the judge recognized that there were no immunity or other issues. There was no Rooker-Feldman issue. But we were unhappy with the 10% of the decision where Judge St. Eve decided that there was collateral estoppel effect because Linda Reed had requested that a state court judge give her accommodations, and twice the judge entered, presumably orally and then in writing, orders that she had enough accommodations, she didn't need anything more. What she had asked for, in addition to rest time and a podium and somebody to help her keep notes during the proceedings, were a microphone, the one I'm using right now, and also having a proxy, somebody who could speak for her when she was unable to speak due to her neurological and mental disabilities. So the question is whether those orders by the state court judge should have collateral estoppel effect. And we had argued to the judge both that there was no identity of issues because the issue of appropriate accommodations during a trial raised different issues in the context of a new trial motion where the question was whether in the overall scheme of the trial, whether she was denied a fair trial. And under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act, where the issue is whether if Ms. Reed demonstrated that it was a reasonable accommodation, whether it was an undue burden on the court to provide those accommodations. And so there was no identity of issues. We also presented the argument in the alternative that it would be unjust to apply the state law defense of equitable estoppel in our original argument, that we argued that it was circular, that it gave the state court judge essentially the final word on whether the accommodations abided by federal law. And then we elaborated on that in our 59E motion to also explain that based on the way the judge wrote the order, it would be very difficult for any claimant to raise a claim in federal court that their rights were violated under the ADA and Rehabilitation Act if a judge, state court judge, could say, well, I did everything right.
What's unfair about that?
Because it means that she has no recourse to a federal remedy under the ADA or Rehabilitation Act.
That's a statement of what the consequences are. What's unfair about that?
If a pro se litigant in state court invokes the ADA in passing to say, I have rights, she had no realistic opportunity to develop in state court why denying her a microphone, denying her a proxy to speak for her, would violate the specifics of federal law.
Why was there no opportunity? I thought there was an opportunity, and in fact, this was fully litigated as an issue. It wasn't litigated as an ADA claim, but it was the issue was litigated of the accommodation in all its forms. Okay. And so, state courts are not unfair fora. State courts are on par with federal courts for litigating these claims, and there's nothing unfair about what occurred here specifically. And so there's certainly nothing unfair as a general matter.
Well,
I understand your argument to be sort of a general argument that it's unfair because it's a catch-22.
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. It is a catch-22.
But why is it unfair to have state courts adjudicate these accommodation claims? State judges are just as good at doing that as federal judges.
If Linda Reed had had the opportunity as a pro se litigant to present this to Judge Jones as a reasonable accommodation claim, meaning that the burden shifted to the judge at that point to demonstrate why there was an undue burden to provide a microphone and a proxy, that would approach closer to what you're describing. But that opportunity sincerely, especially considering the pro se status of the litigant in this case, really didn't exist. We've also argued that this interferes.
Why did it not exist?
She was not on notice. She was on notice that she had general rights under federal law. She was not apprised of how effective communications works under the ADA and the Rehabilitation
Act. Well, the court doesn't have an obligation to give her a primer in ADA law. The court just has an obligation to consider the accommodation issue, and we accord collateral estoppel effect if the judge did that, which the judge did here.
You're right that he considered whether the accommodations should have been provided, what he decided.
Yeah, but he specifically considered whether they were reasonable, right?
Well, in the decision, the order that we have, he said that I gave you essentially enough accommodations. I gave you rests. I gave you a podium. I let somebody write notes. We don't have insight about why she was denied a microphone, why she was denied a proxy to speak for her when she couldn't talk for herself.
Is it correct that there's no transcript of the state proceeding?
That's right, Your Honor. The Misery did not order a transcript. When she took her appeal, she took it of issues where she didn't need the
was
transcript.
Was there any medical evidence about her condition?
I don't believe any was presented at trial, no, Your Honor.
And she didn't raise this reasonable accommodation argument in her direct appeal, right?
All she did was mention the federal law, and as Judge St. Eve said, that essentially preserved the opportunity for the appellate court to rule on it, but she did not raise it as a direct issue on appeal. You're right. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mull. Mr. Welch?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welch. I'm here on behalf of the defendants' appellees. The question here is quite narrow, and it's whether, you know, the plaintiff has collaterally stopped with raising the reasonable accommodation issue in the federal court. And the answer is yes, because she's already litigated it in the state court. The plaintiff's post-judgment motion makes very specific argument about the Americans with Disabilities Act. She has at pages 15 and 16, she says the Americans with Disabilities Act. She says that she was denied reasonable accommodation.
Why wasn't there a transcript of the state?
I'm actually not sure there wasn't a transcript taken. I don't know that the state court defendant didn't have a court reporter. Apparently, Ms. Reed decided not to pay for the transcript, but I don't know that there wasn't the opportunity to have a transcript. My understanding is in the state court municipal division that you have to bring your own court reporter. And I have read things that lead me to believe that the state court defendants had a court reporter, but I don't know that for a fact. But what's important here is that
wouldn't it be helpful to look at the transcript to see how severe her disability is, or how effective the accommodation was to enable her to, I don't know, articulate her case?
Well, certainly on direct appeal, if she had wanted to pursue the ADA reasonable accommodation issue, she would have had to supply a transcript so that it could verify or not her argument that she wasn't able to make a comprehensible.
What do you mean supply a transcript? You mean she has to pay for a transcript?
Yes, every appellant has to pay for their own transcript. I mean, unless it's been filed by the...
Huh? What does it cost?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe $1 a page. I'm not sure. It's probably similar to what the federal transcripts cost. Mm-hmm. And also, if she were indigent, she could ask. We have litigants that you can ask the court to waive the transcript
cost. You can get the court to provide a transcript. She never made that request.
No, I don't believe she filed IFP, so I don't know that she... in her state court case. I mean, she didn't hear, as far as I know. So the question that the court is focused on so far is fairness. And certainly, plaintiff had both an opportunity and an incentive to litigate the ADA issue, reasonable accommodation issue, and she took that opportunity. She raised it in her post-judgment motion very specifically, and the judge in the post-trial order addressed it very specifically. In fact, the judge says, this court has no doubt but that her readily observable speech impediment, and remember her post-trial motion said that she had a speech impediment, that that was her disability. Her impediment concern was accommodated, and that she was thus fully afforded a fair and adequate opportunity to present her case, which she accomplished at a level that far exceeded that of most pro se litigants in jury trials in spite of her condition. That's at 61-2 at page 6. So the circuit court addressed quite specifically whether the issue of whether she had had a meaningful opportunity to be heard, and that is the crux under Lane of the access to the courts question for litigants with disabilities. In Lane, you know, the court said what the ADA is designed to do is to provide a meaningful opportunity to be heard by lifting the obstacles that prevent participation in the court in a judicial proceedings. And here, certainly, plaintiff participated fully in the state court proceedings. The judge acknowledged this. The judge says in several ways that she participated fully despite her impediment, her disability.
So then your position would be that if she felt that the district court was wrong, she should have made that direct appeal at state court in the state court system, and that would be it.
Absolutely. That's what she should have done. She, by abandoning it on direct appeal, she lost, you know, she lost her opportunity to pursue this issue, to litigate it to the end. She could have, in fact, gone to the Supreme Court. It is not irrationally exuberant to suggest that plaintiff could have gone to the Supreme Court with a cert petition saying, I was denied a meaningful opportunity to be heard in the state court because I was not accommodated. My disability was not reasonably accommodated. She could have done that. She didn't.
And so let's say she went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, doesn't get relief. Could she then come to federal court saying there was some kind of violation?
No,
and
she would
run into the same
no,
problem.
She would, right, she would run into the same problem. What she had to do, what you do in that case is you do what the Lane plaintiff did, and you know, the Tennessee versus Lane plaintiff, you go to federal court. You don't exhaust, as it were, you don't set up your preclusion problem in the state court. You go to federal court either, you know, during or after the proceedings, but you don't make the issue, you don't make it an issue in your state court proceedings. And because that's what leads to preclusion. It could have led to Rooker-Feldman if the proceedings had been finished, when we moved to dismiss, but the proceedings were still ongoing, so Rooker-Feldman didn't apply.
Do you accept the description in the plaintiff's opening brief of the of her condition?
For the purposes of summary judgment, yes, or 12B6. For the purposes of 12B6, yes, of course.
Well, she says she was granted some of her requests, a note taker, a podium, and occasional recesses.
Correct.
But without explanation, she was denied a microphone, an interpreter to speak on her behalf, and a jury charge explaining the nature of her disability. I don't understand that.
Do you not understand?
I don't understand why the judge didn't give her those things.
Because he believed that they weren't necessary. In fact,
I should think the jury charge would be extremely necessary.
I believe actually he did discuss this with the jury, and he in fact said in his post-trial motion that he thought that the jury liked her and was not at all affected by that its decision was not at all affected by her speech, her disability.
So then he specifically told the jury that. But what her disability was, because that's what she's saying was missing. the jury didn't understand the nature of her disability.
I don't think there was a charge to the jury.
That's what I'm interpreting that
right.
to me.
Or like a jury instruction?
An acknowledgement. Yeah, at the beginning of the trial, you know, in the preliminary instructions, explaining that she has this condition, that they shouldn't hold that against her in any way, that because of her condition, there might be longer recesses or whatever. None of that was done, right?
Well, I think, and the reason it wasn't, as the trial court judge said, at all times, she at all times presented as being fully mentally capable and alert, physically able, except for the speech condition. It was necessary to take several steps to accommodate that disability, and then he describes those. So to him, these were the reasons that
right.
it was.
And what I'm saying, did he articulate that to the jury?
She also states in the brief that the judge became impatient with her.
Right, and the judge addressed that in the post-trial motion. He says there were occasions when her pauses were so lengthy that the court concluded she was being indecisive rather than.
How on earth could the judge? Really? Could the judge distinguish between what she was doing because of this list of rather horrible illnesses in the brief, which you say you accept, between that and some kind of strategic concealment?
Well, certainly judges make these sorts of decisions every day, whether witnesses are stalling or
Yeah, but if you're dealing with a person with all the ailments that are listed here, diseases I've never heard of, you don't have a. If the judge has questions about it, why doesn't he appoint a medical expert to advise him on the nature of her condition?
Well, if I can finish what the judge said about this very issue. Which she brought up in her post-trial motion, that she was being indecisive rather than laboring under the impediment, and she was asked to move on, as would any other individual. So the trial court judge...
But she's not any other individual.
Well, Your Honor, if I may continue, at those times she appeared able to fully respond and proceed in a most functional manner. So the trial judge observed her, was at first person observing...
That is so naive. To think that a judge or any lay person can diagnose the condition of a person with these horrible ailments.
The trial judge had conversations and dealings with the plaintiff for over quite a long time. I think he was in the perfect position to understand the extent.
He perfectly understood her ailment, tardive dyskinesia, tongue thrusting, pursing, choking, side to side chewing, involuntary movements through her body constantly, becomes mute, screams, or makes nonverbal sounds. Sounds terrible.
Well, again, Your Honor, the trial court judge found that she accomplished her trial proceeding at a level that far exceeded that of most pro se litigants in jury trials.
She also says she suffered these embarrassments in front of the jury. This is a piece of gum she chewed fell out of her mouth. He scolded her before the jury. She entered a convulsive state in the sight of the jury, causing disruption and humiliation. Her nose was running, which was a side effect of the drugs. She didn't have a tissue. The daughter got but I want to focus on. I understand he looked at the jury and thought the jury was sympathetic.
Correct.
From observing.
Correct.
But he never said to the jury, here's her situation. In reaching a verdict in this case, you should not consider her behavior. She has certain medical challenges. I don't have all the language that I would personally give. Mm-hmm. And that you can't hold that against her in any way, and that any delays that we have or any of her mannerisms that you see are a result of her medical condition, and so you shouldn't hold it against her. That was never said.
No, Your Honor. In fact, in the post-trial order, the judge says the prospective jurors were asked whether the plaintiff's impediment would prevent them from giving the parties a fair trial, and the sworn jury was reminded several times not to hold her condition against her or
and
the defendant.
What kind of explanation did he give of her condition?
I'm not sure what the extent of it was, but certainly the issue was addressed several times.
But you see, the problem is her symptoms could be symptoms of just an angry, disruptive person, or they can be the result of a disease, or they could be both. And if the judge thought that she had some genuine symptoms, but that she was also uncooperative and so on, then he should have had a medical expert advise him, you know, is this all her disease, or is she exaggerating, or what?
Well, first, Your Honor,
otherwise, he doesn't have the capacity to make those distinctions.
Well, first, Your Honor, plaintiff didn't ask for that. And second, Your Honor, the trial judge, certainly trial judges are, I think we know this generally, the trial judges are given the task of making these decisions.
No, they're not given the task of psychological or physical diagnosis.
Your Honor, if she had, again, she didn't ask for that accommodation, and I think that to have a standby,
I think the judge would think of it by himself. I have a person who may be sick, or maybe some kind of malinger or something, or maybe a mixture of them. I have to find out what this person's condition is, and I have to explain this to the jury.
Your Honor, I don't think that's the way the ADA works. I think the ADA works is that the person with a disability...
Well, this is wonderfully absurd, isn't it? What you're saying is a person who is disabled has to be able to articulate her disability? What are you talking about?
Your Honor, that's what the disability
coordinator... So if the person was mute or something, you say, well, she didn't say, she didn't ask for an accommodation because she can't speak, therefore she doesn't get it. That's what you're saying.
I don't know that that's what I'm saying, Your Honor.
I think that's what you're saying.
I don't believe it is. But if I may, I see my time is almost up.
I just have a quick question. So she didn't ask for IFP status, nor did she ask for counsel?
I'm sorry?
Did she ask for counsel to be appointed?
In the state court case?
Yes.
I believe she did, actually.
And that was rejected by the court?
Yes, certainly.
And the reason for that?
I don't know that the reason is on the record. My guess would be that it would not be a reasonable accommodation, that it would change the function of the court to start supplying counsel to people with disabilities.
So there's no such process in the state court where the court can appoint someone in a civil case where someone has at least alleged that they have a disability.
Certainly, the possibility
I have
is
in the circuit court of Cook County, so I don't know. So that's why I'm
right.
Curious.
I mean,
isn't there a process whereby a state court judge can appoint someone to represent a plaintiff in a case like this?
This I don't know, Your Honor. Certainly litigants have no due process right to have counsel in a civil case. So the ADA is really the functional equivalent for with regard to a disability, so that if it would seem to me that if you don't have a 14th Amendment right generally to have counsel appointed for you in a civil case, then it's because it's not a due process requirement, then I think that you wouldn't have it in an ADA case, because the ADA is the 14th Amendment access to the courts, removing barriers because of your disability.
Well,
so I would guess
I'm
not.
The reason I'm asking is that the district judges here routinely appoint counsel for pro se litigants for
well,
a variety of reasons.
There's a statute for that, Your Honor.
And that's why I'm trying to find out what goes on in the circuit.
Right.
Court.
And it's also
what's available. That's what I'm trying
right.
to get at.
I think that's, I mean, for IFP status, that's true, but there's recruited counsel in district court, in federal court. I don't know that that's true in state court. I just don't know.
Okay.
Again, just to close, plaintiff actually fully litigated the issue of reasonable accommodation in the state court, and because she did, she is collaterally estopped here, and it's not unfair to apply collateral estoppel here because she had this opportunity and then abandoned it on direct appeal. She also could have gone to district court and not raised the issue at all in her post-judgment motion, and yet she did, and that is why collateral estoppel is in fact applicable here. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Welsh. Mr. Malika?
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Williams, I'm not sure what the history was about appointing counsel, but the record is that Ms. Reed, her health deteriorated right before trial. So the circumstances for the years while the case was pending was quite different. The only thing I want to add is that, as I heard Ms. Welsh describing this, my client's best alternative to getting federal relief would have been to just skip over the interactive process part of the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act and leap into court to get an injunction or some kind of relief. But this court and every court, Court of Appeals, more or less insists that disabled claimants first try to work out their problems with the institution or the employer before they invoke federal jurisdiction. And what happened here is she, in good faith, worked both with the disabled coordinator, Ms. Bryce, and also tried to work with the judge. And what we're hearing today is by invoking the ADA interactive process with the judge, she collaterally stopped herself from ever getting federal relief. That's not only unfair, it defies the whole ADA and Rehabilitation Act process.
No, it just means the state courts decide the issue.
There's nothing
unfair about state courts adjudicating ADA accommodation claims.
It would mean that it would be very difficult for a claimant to try to work things out with a state court judge in these cases.
It can be reviewed on appeal to the Intermediate Court of Appeals and the Illinois Supreme Court and potentially the U.S. Supreme Court as well.
It's just
if you come into federal court on the same claim, you're going to be collaterally estopped, federal
then
district court.
You're right, Your Honor, and then the answer would be that after this decision came down, that every claimant in state court would simply just jump over here. They wouldn't bother asking the judge or the disability coordinator to help them, because why should they? They'll be collaterally stopped.
They won't have a claim in federal court because they have to make the request for the accommodation.
And that's why you've created
the
dilemma.
That's not a problem if we trust state courts to adjudicate these claims fairly. And for a federal court to say that we don't trust state courts to accommodate or decide accommodation claims fairly, that would be a pretty extraordinary statement from a federal court.
All I'd have to say, Your Honor, is based on the allegations of the complaint, this judge was singularly unable to handle the accommodation, and I don't think that he earned the trust of this court under these circumstances, Your Honor.
So let me ask you this. So you're saying that once she got the verdict, then she should have come over here to federal court, not asked him for any relief in the pretrial post.
Based on what I'm hearing,
motions.
Based on what I'm hearing, sorry, Your Honor.
No, I mean that's what you're saying. And then she wouldn't ask for a motion to reconsider.
Yeah, based on what I'm hearing from the Attorney General, that's right. She should have come over here and gotten an injunction. But that's a preposterous reading of the federal statutes.
So let me ask you this: in terms of the accommodation, she tries to work it out initially pre-trial, right?
Right, Your Honor.
Okay, and then she tries to work it out during the trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not to her satisfaction. She gets the verdict.
Right.
She comes over here.
I will say this, Your Honor. I don't know what the record is during trial. I know the pre- and post-trial proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And she didn't make any requests for counsel when her medical condition changed, when she deteriorated?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, and I don't know what the procedure would have been.
Okay. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Malika and Ms. Welsh.